broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Let me tell you a story. A Frenchman walks into a New York City bar. He has a frog perched on his head. "Hey," the bartender says, "that's cute. Where did you get him?" "France," the frog says. "They got millions of them over there." Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Okay, the Frenchman's story is a joke, and one you've probably already heard. But a joke is also a story form, a type of storytelling among thousands of different constructs and means of expression. But whether spontaneous or finely crafted, type doesn't really matter, does it? We humans simply love stories. They delight us as children, amuse and stir our emotions as adults, and comfort us in our advancing age. Everything needs a story. Faith, science, love, all need stories for people to embrace them, to identify with them, and find them credible. Stories are also contextual. They have the power to bring hope where there is none, strengthen character when it is challenged, give strength when tragedy strikes. Stories have the power to change lives. So it should be no surprise that storytelling is common to every known culture. Tell me a story is older than language itself. Think of cave paintings, for example, and even older, pantomiming, which today we might call theater, and especially dance as storytelling. So in this holiday season, a season of storytelling, here are two stories for you, read by actors with the Community Players of Salisbury. Neither story, I have to confess, is particularly seasonal, but I hope they please and delight you nonetheless. The first segment is read by Mike Murphy. Mike is an emergency medical services doctor here in Salisbury. The story he's going to read is that of an older man whose deceased wife has taken up residence in his mind. It was written by your host. The second story, Lamb to the Slaughter, is read by Judy Hearn, a retired teacher here in Salisbury. Lamb to the Slaughter was written by Roald Dahl and was featured in the television series Alfred Hitchcock Presents back in April 1958. In fact, I remember seeing it when it first aired. And now, Mike Murphy and segment.
Helen was a little awkward now. Tall, straight black hair, then iron gray, pulled back but not severe. Gray suits, white blouse, all business. She had been rather stately. She moved with purpose, but still, James could not predict her intent. She lived only in his head. It was a month after her death that she took up residence there. Where she had been in the interregnum, what she had done, James had no idea. She simply appeared one day and assumed the same role she had played in life, coming and going at will, ordering his thoughts around her own, demanding logical consideration of her opinions. It was not an unhappy circumstance. James found her good company. True, she could be a bit obstinate, dominating personal conversations or quietly observing James as he tried to organize his affairs. But she did keep his mind occupied and was only occasionally an inconvenience. And even though she did absent herself from time to time, and James did find himself more relaxed during those moments of release, he could never tell her to go away. That would betray a rudeness and lack of consideration James could not support. After all, he had lived with her for 40 years and had no problem supporting her existence now. At the same time, she was a presence that asserted itself, demanded recognition, and stood in James' mind, an entity entirely separate from himself. The line at the checkout counter wasn't moving. James's few purchases sat immobile on a small section of the conveyor belt. Ellen was not with him. The woman behind James leaned forward and placed a separator between his groceries and her own. Her hand entered James's field of vision, and he turned to look at her. "The Berlin Wall," the woman said. "It makes it easier for the girl." The girl, James noted, was in fact a boy, scanning items and punching keys. So young, his face still carried the red splotches of adolescence. How times have changed, James thought. The generic checkout girl was a boy now, with rings through his nose, ears, lips, and yes, even one eyebrow. "Maginot line," James replied, and looking at the woman, reached forward and placed another separator next to the one she had installed. She smiled and fingered the separators that cordoned off her purchases. An apple, red, a peach, a single banana, a pineapple, and three large purple plums. "Fruit salad?" James asked, waving a finger at her items. "Still life first," she said, "then fruit salad." "Food for the soul and for the body," James said. "You know, all of these are symbolic of something." "Isn't everything?" the woman said. The conveyor moved 6 inches and stopped. "You paint, I take it." "Some, but pottery is my medium." James looked at her hands. Flecks of her work showed around her nails. No rings. The man in front of James paid his bill and was gone. Now face to face with the splotchy boy and his face of rings, James turned again to the woman. "You come here often?" he said, sliding his credit card. Then, "Just kidding, just kidding." And he held up his hands in mock surrender, the credit card a flag of submission in his right hand. The woman smiled. "Are you trying to pick me up? Here? In the grocery store, no less? And without even buying me a drink?" "The Maginot line," she said, gently waving the separators. James took up his bags and turned again to the woman. "Yes," he said, "but keep in mind they both failed." "Well, what was that all about?" Ellen said. James turned the key in the ignition. "Just being friendly, Ellen." "Were you trying to pick her up?" "Don't be silly." "I wouldn't mind, you know. It is time you found someone. Moved on, isn't that what they say?" "Ellen, I'm 65. I don't go around picking up young women at the grocery store." "Young? She's 60 if she's a day," Ellen said. "Still, it would be nice for you." "I wouldn't mind. Really." The car was moving through traffic now, home. The route fixed. Familiar. James imagined the potter woman. Her hands, particularly her hands. Those strong hands with bits of dried clay around her nails. And he gently rotated his own hands on the steering wheel. Ellen had been a beautiful woman. An attorney, a litigator for an insurance company, she had been ruthless. No quarter given and none expected. True to her character, she had been possessive, particularly with James. What others saw as covetous, however, James saw as protective. He knew that she loved him and wanted nothing to hurt him, especially not another woman. As a result, she guarded him as closely and as relentlessly as she did the insurance company for which she worked. At the same time, James saw her embrace as gentle, a kindness that nurtured and sustained him, and he accepted her possessive nature as a benefit now. Aisle 9, Dairy. James was searching for Pepper Jack cheese. Hidden among their slight differences, the packages all looked alike to James. Pizza tonight, he thought. And when he glanced up, her cart was right in front of him, intentionally blocking the aisle, James imagined. He gave her cart a slight bump. "Well," he said, "you do come here often." "I do now, Mr. James. Just call me James. And you are... Caroline? Caroline will do. James pointed to Caroline's cart. Milk, butter, and eggs. Your next still life? I can see it now. The Middle Ages, a farm wife table, a straw hat, and a clay pipe to set the era. Add a little chiaroscuro, and it could be a Van Gogh. Not this time, Mr. James. It'll be a cake when I'm through. I do have a straw hat, though. Lemon cake. Do you like lemon cake, Mr. James? Please, it's just James. Is that an invitation, Miss Caroline will do? We'll see. You still haven't bought me that drink, have you? See you at the checkout counter. But she wasn't in any of the checkout lines when James arrived. You ran into that woman again, didn't you? Ellen said. The car was hot. James lowered the windows and sat for a moment. Then he saw her pushing her cart across the parking lot. Is that her? James, really, not exactly your type, is she? Looks kind of masculine to me. Is she married? Does she have children? Why are you staring at her? Ellen, please, not now. Go visit your mother or something. You know my mother is dead, James. So are you, Ellen. Remember? Go find her. Have a little chat. James was no fool. Even though he did treat Ellen like she was real, he knew she was a figment of his imagination now. The conversation he was having with himself. But still, there were times when he could hear her voice clearly, feel her touch, sense the warmth of her body, her dark, enticing smell, and knew the otherness of her personality. At those times, he was not quite sure. It was all memory, of course. He knew that. But still, if it was all memory, why was she so present? And what did she want hanging around in his head? And what did he want? Not the woman in the grocery store, Caroline. He was no flirt. He was not interested in a relationship. Was he? It was nice to think of the possibilities, though, that someone might still find him interesting, and at his age. James watched Caroline load her groceries, back out of her space, and then she was gone. It's not that easy, James, Ellen said. Are you going to sit here all day? What were you thinking about? Dreaming about that woman, were you? Start the car, James. Caroline was not thinking about James as she pushed her cart across the parking lot. Her mind was on her pottery business. The pot she had been working on all day, now broken. It was really nothing but dirt and a little water. 60 years, and here she was playing in the mud like a child. They were the basic elements, though, weren't they? Earth, air, fire, and water? Who was it said that? Some Greek? Well, he got it right, didn't he? Take some dirt, add water, form it, mold it, invest energy, time, imagination, hope your hands don't tremble, that your eye is good, then slide it into the fire. And if the shape tells a story, and the colors excite the imagination, elicit emotion, then it's declared art, and people pay money. And if not, if the hand shakes, if the form collapses, if the symmetry is off, the eye fails and the arc doesn't sweep and complement, then it is put in the back room to be crushed back to earth. The pot had been beautiful. Full, round, graceful, perfect symmetry, ready for the glaze. Then shards on the floor. Pieces to tell the future, pieces to bring luck, and not a wedding in sight. Pieces to be pounded back into dirt. But it was not even the pot. She had broken pieces before. Long hours of work crumpled to dust. Why should this one be different? What do? Start again. Keep starting again until finally you are ground to dirt like the pots. The pot maker, even this master pot maker, is no more than the substance of her labor. Genesis, isn't it? God formed man and all the other animals, for that matter, from the dust of the earth. Water? It doesn't say, but there had to be water. Nothing sticks without water. Air? God breathed in this creature's face, and there was being. Fire? Ah, here is the greatest irony of all. The fire, the kiln. To harden, to break, to bring out beauty, to dry and make brittle. The kiln, Caroline discovered, is life itself. The groceries long ago packed in the car. The car now sitting in the driveway, Caroline was alone, depressed and angry. And that was the crux of the issue. It wasn't all that existential hoo-ha about pots and dirt. It was the simple fact that she was growing old, alone. Men had come and gone in her life, mostly gone. Her few friends were vacuous, and her mother was in a nursing home or somewhere else altogether. And it had all happened without her really noticing. Life had been full of work, friends, men, her mother, and then one day she turned and turned again and found that the waltz had long ended, the dance floor empty. Just like that, Caroline discovered herself alone. And then she thought of James. "Every day, James," Ellen said, "you go to that grocery store every day now. My God, you're like a French housewife. Marketing. Always marketing. Coming home with your little packages, bread and cheese one day, milk and butter the next, then a little something for dinner. Looking for that woman, aren't you? Caroline, that pottery lady. Hoping you'll run into her. You should be ashamed of yourself. Stalking the frozen foods aisle like some deranged old fogey. You'll probably have better luck finding her in the geriatric section. Vitamins, laxatives, energy shakes." "Stop it, Ellen. Stay in the car. I'm going to do this." And then she was there. And it was in the frozen foods aisle. "Mr. James," Caroline said. "How surprising to find you here." "Oh, hello, Miss Caroline will do. Frozen dinner tonight, I see. No cooking?" "Not tonight. Orders to fill. I'm afraid I'll be throwing pots for most of the night. You do still owe me that drink, though." James looked through the heavy glass windows towards the parking lot. "I'm at your disposal, my lady. My time is my own, so please name the time and place." "How about tomorrow at 10, Maroni's? We'll have coffee and see if we can stand each other." Caroline's strategy was transparent. A sane hour, easy escape if things were unbearable. Caroline arrived early and chose a table on the patio next to the sidewalk. A lot of distractions available so she wouldn't have to focus on Mr. James if she didn't want to. She had chosen flats, Levi's, and a simple white starched blouse with a small teapot embroidered on the left lapel. She had considered the preen navy hope pants and blue teacup print Darjeeling blouse by Brigazzi classy, but decided quickly against them. They both said money, and she wasn't ready to betray that information. James, in the uniform of the day, khakis and a blue blazer, pushed through the bustle in the patio and sat across from her. He ordered espresso and Caroline ordered tea. In the difference, James felt a slight note of discord. Then he looked at her hands. Those hands again, scrubbed but small stains of clay showed in the cracks and creases of the knuckles. They were hands that made things. Hands that were not tentative. Hands that were sure of themselves. They belied the delicate femininity of their owner. James loved those hands. He looked up to her face. Caroline smiled and James lost all the composure he had managed to assemble. Their conversation was inquisitive. Information gathering. Who did what and when. Marriages, children, grandchildren, until all the gathering had been done. James, a retired owner of a company he had built up over the years, then sold. One marriage to Ellen, an attorney. Two children, a boy and a girl, miles away now. All quite simple, quite ordinary. Caroline, potter, artist, businesswoman, maker of original dinnerware for one client, Neiman Marcus. Three employees, throws pots for individual clients on occasion and on request, exhibits her work from time to time. Not retired, never married, devoted to her mother. A little more complex, a little more aggressive. Neither mentioned health issues. James was asked and did talk about Ellen. In fact, he said a little more than he had intended, and he thought of her waiting in the car. They talked for more than 2 hours. The different preferences for strong coffee and for plain tea that had worried James turned out to be simply a matter of taste and metabolism, and not reflective of any personality quirks. As they were preparing to leave, Caroline took a small figurine from her purse and placed it on the table. "It's a little trinket I made," she said. "I thought you might like it." James picked up the figure and turned it over in his fingers. "A sort of lion's head?" he said. "It's Sekhmet," Caroline said. "A lion goddess. Egyptian. My characterization." The sculpture was a black glaze of a lion's head, placed on the thin torso of a woman, her breasts prominent. It was about 2 inches in height and unmistakably Egyptian in style. A circular collar framed the face with straight lines of hair dropping on either side. The face itself was almost human, with the eyes the most striking feature. Set off by high cheekbones, they were at the same time sympathetic and penetrating, and along with the strong leonine nose, demanded attention. It was an impressive figure, somewhat impenetrable, and James wasn't sure what to expect of it. "Sekhmet is both dangerous and destructive, as well as protective and healing," Caroline said. "She's the daughter of Ra, and is also known as the Mistress of Life. Set her somewhere in your house where she can see you, and perhaps she'll protect you. Or not. James had brought nothing, and he was embarrassed. I'm sorry, he said. I didn't expect... Think nothing of it, James, Caroline said, rising from the table. Let me at least buy you dinner, James said. Tomorrow night? That's something more substantial than tea. James knew Ellen would be waiting when he got back to the car. He dropped the figurine into his coat pocket and slid behind the wheel. So that was the girlfriend, Ellen said. That thing she gave you. Let's have a look at it. James took the statue from his pocket, studied it for a moment, and placed it on the dashboard. Not a bad likeness, Ellen said. Please put it away now. And that was the beginning of things, and that was the ending of things. James's relationship with Caroline grew and deepened in affection. Ellen became less of a presence and more of a memory until she was thought of with glancing affection. In James's mind, there was never a comparison. Ellen was then, and Caroline was now. The two lives marked off by a mental separator as time carried them both forward. A year on, James and Caroline talked of marriage. They decided to have the honeymoon first. If they were really compatible, could actually bear each other in close proximity for extended periods of time, they would marry and care for each other in their advancing years. They decided on a river cruise in the Loire Valley of France. What better than cramped life on a small boat, a river barge really, isolated by language, with only two other couples to test the endurance of a relationship. The wedding took place in May. James had long since put the settlement of his house and furnishings in the hands of his children and moved in with Caroline. It was a large, 2.5-story blue Victorian house with white trim. On a small hill, it was almost Gothic in appearance. It had been her mother's house. The full basement had its own access and was dedicated to Caroline's pottery business. When they returned from the wedding reception, Caroline and James were met in the entry hall by a strange odor. It was a heavy, pungent animal odor, like musk, but with a sickly sweet tint as well. The smell was contained, its dimensions identifiable. For a moment, it followed them down the hallway and then seemed to lose interest and disappeared. A week later, James was at his desk on the third floor writing thank you notes for their wedding gifts when the odor appeared again. Strong, dense, a mixture of animal and human scent. Came up behind him, embraced his body, and seemed to be looking over his shoulder. Ellen?
Beautifully read, Mike. Thank you very much. And now, Judy Hearn and Lamb to the Slaughter.
The room was warm and clean. The curtains drawn, the two table lamps alight, hers and the one by the empty chair opposite. On the sideboard behind her, two tall glasses, soda water, whiskey, fresh ice cubes in the thermos bucket. Mary Maloney was waiting for her husband to come home from work. Now and again, she would glance up at the clock, but without anxiety, merely to please herself with the thought that each minute gone by made it nearer the time when he would come. There was a slow, smiling air about her, and about everything she did. The drop of a head as she bent over her sewing was curiously tranquil. Her skin, for this was her 6th month with child, had acquired a wonderful translucent quality. The mouth was soft, and the eyes, with their new placid look, seemed larger, darker than before. When the clock said 5:10, she began to listen, and a few moments later, punctually as always, she heard the tires on the gravel outside and the car door slamming, the footsteps passing the window, the key turning in the lock. She laid aside her sewing, stood up, and went forward to kiss him as he came in. "Hello, darling," she said. "Hello, darling," he answered. She took his coat and hung it in the closet. Then she walked over and made the drinks, a strongish one for him, a weak one for herself, and soon she was back again in her chair with the sewing, and he in the other opposite, holding the tall glass with both hands, rocking it so the ice cubes tinkled against the side. For her, this was always a blissful time of day. She knew he didn't want to speak much until his first drink was finished, and she, on her side, was content to sit quietly, enjoying his company after the long hours alone in the house. She loved to luxuriate in the presence of this man, and to feel, almost as a sunbather feels the sun, that warm male glow that came out of him to her when they were alone together. She loved him for the way he sat loosely in a chair, for the way he came in a door or moved slowly across the room with long strides. She loved the intent, faraway look in his eyes when they rested in her, the funny shape of the mouth, and especially the way he remained silent about his tiredness, sitting still with himself until the whiskey had taken some of it away. "Tired, darling?" "Yes," he said, "I'm tired." And as he spoke, he did an unusual thing. He lifted his glass and drained it in one swallow, although there was still at least half of it left. She wasn't really watching him, but she knew what he had done because she heard the ice cubes falling back against the bottom of the empty glass when he lowered his arm. He paused a moment, leaning forward in the chair. Then he got up and went slowly over to fetch himself another. "I'll get it," she cried, jumping up. "Sit down," he said. When he came back, she noticed that the new drink was dark amber with the quantity of whiskey in it. "Darling, shall I get your slippers?" "No." She watched him as he began to sip the dark yellow drink, and she could see little oily swirls in the liquid because it was so strong. "I think it's a shame," she said, "that when a policeman gets to be as senior as you, they keep him walking about on his feet all day long." He didn't answer, so she bent her head again and went on with her sewing. But each time he lifted the drink to his lips, she heard the ice cubes clinking against the sides of the glass. "Darling," she said, "would you like me to get you some cheese? I haven't made any supper because it's Thursday." "No," he said. "Yeah, if you're too tired to eat out," she went on, "it's still not too late. There's plenty of meat and stuff in the freezer. You can have it right here and not even move out of the chair." Her eyes waited on him for an answer. Smile, a little nod, but he made no sign. "Anyway," she went on, "I'll get you some cheese and crackers first." "I don't want it," he said. She moved uneasily in her chair, the large eyes still watching his face. "But you must eat. I'll fix it anyway, and then you can have it, or not, as you like." She stood up and placed her sewing on the table by the lamp. "Sit down," he said. "Just for a minute, sit down." It wasn't until then that she began to get frightened. "Go on," he said. "Sit down." She lowered herself slowly back into the chair, watching him all the time with those large, bewildered eyes. He had finished the second drink and was staring into the glass, frowning. "Listen," he said, "I've got something to tell you." "What is it, darling? What's the matter?" He had now become absolutely motionless, and he kept his head down so that the light from the lamp beside him fell across the upper part of his face, leaving the chin and mouth in shadow. She noticed there was a little muscle moving near the corner of his left eye. "This is going to be a bit of a shock to you, I'm afraid," he said, "but I've thought about it a good deal, and I've decided the only thing to do is tell you right away. I hope you won't blame me too much." And he told her. It didn't take long, 4 or 5 minutes at most, and she sat very still through it all, watching him with a kind of dazed horror as he went further and further away from her with each word. "So there it is," he added. "And I know it's kind of a bad time to be telling you, but there simply wasn't any other way. Of course, I'll give you money and see you're looked after, but there really needn't be any fuss. I hope not, anyway. It would be very bad for my job." Her first instinct was not to believe any of it, to reject it all. It occurred to her that perhaps he hadn't even spoken, that she herself had imagined the whole thing. Maybe if she went about her business and acted as though she hadn't been listening, then later, when she sort of woke up again, she might find none of it had ever happened. "I'll get the supper," she managed to whisper, and this time he didn't stop her. When she walked across the room, she couldn't feel her feet touching the floor. She couldn't feel anything at all, except a slight nausea and a desire to vomit. Everything was automatic now. Down the steps to the cellar, the light switch, the deep freeze, the hand inside the cabinet taking hold of the first object it met. She lifted it out and looked at it. It was wrapped in paper, so she took off the paper and looked at it again. A leg of lamb. All right, then. They would have lamb for supper. She carried it upstairs, holding the thin bone end of it with both her hands, and as she went through the living room, she saw him standing over by the window with his back to her, and she stopped. "For God's sake," he said, hearing her but not turning around, "don't make supper for me. I'm going out." At that point, Mary Maloney simply walked up behind him, and without any pause, she swung the big frozen leg of lamb high in the air and brought it down as hard as she could on the back of his head. She might just as well have hit him with a steel club. She stepped back a pace, waiting, and the funny thing was that he remained standing there for at least 4 or 5 seconds, gently swaying. Then he crashed to the carpet. The violence of the crash, the noise, the small table overturning, helped bring her out of the shock. She came out slowly, feeling cold and surprised, and she stood for a while blinking at the body, still holding the ridiculous piece of meat tight with both hands. "All right," she told herself, "so I've killed him." It was extraordinary now how clear her mind became all of a sudden. She began thinking very fast. As the wife of a detective, she knew quite well what the penalty would be. That was fine. It made no difference to her. In fact, it would be a relief. On the other hand, what about the child? What were the laws about murderers with unborn children? Did they kill them both, mother and child, or did they wait until the 10th month? What did they do? Mary Maloney didn't know, and she certainly wasn't prepared to take a chance. She carried the meat into the kitchen, placed it in a pan, turned the oven on high, and shoved it inside. Then she washed her hands and ran upstairs to the bedroom. She sat down before the mirror, tidied her hair, touched up her lips and face. She tried a smile. It came out rather peculiar. She tried again. "Hello, Sam," she said brightly, aloud. The voice sounded peculiar, too. "I want some potatoes, please, Sam. Yes, and I think a can of peas." That was better. Both the smile and the voice were coming out better now. She rehearsed it several times more. Then she ran downstairs, took her coat, went out the back door, down the garden, and into the street. It wasn't 6 o'clock yet, and the lights were still on in the grocery shop. "Hello, Sam," she said brightly, smiling at the man behind the counter. "Why, good evening, Mrs. Maloney. How are you?" "I want some potatoes, please, Sam." "Yes, and I think a can of peas." The man turned and reached up behind him on the shelf for the peas. "Patrick's decided he's tired and doesn't want to eat out tonight," she told him. "We usually go out on Thursdays, you know, and now he's caught me without any vegetables in the house." "And how about meat, Mrs. Maloney?" "No, I've got meat, thanks. I got a nice leg of lamb from the freezer." "Oh. I don't know much about cooking it frozen, Sam, but I'm taking a chance on it this time. You think it'll be all right?"
"Personally," the grocer said, "I don't believe it makes any difference."
"You want these Idaho potatoes?" "Oh, yes, that'll be fine. 2 of those.
"Anything else?" The grocer cocked his head on one side, looking at her pleasantly. "How about afterwards? What are you going to give him for afterwards?"
"Well, what would you suggest, Sam?"
The man glanced around his shop. "How about a nice big slice of cheesecake? I know he likes that."
"Perfect," she said. "He loves it."
And when it was all wrapped and she had paid, she put on her brightest smile and said, "Thank you, Sam. Good night." "Good night, Mrs. Maloney, and thank you." And now, she told herself as she hurried back, all she was doing now, she was returning home to her husband, and he was waiting for his supper, and she must cook it good and make it as tasty as possible, because the poor man was tired. And if, when she entered the house, she happened to find anything unusual or tragic or terrible, then naturally it would be a shock, and she'd become frantic with grief and horror. Mind you, she wasn't expecting to find anything. She was just going home with the vegetables. Mrs. Patrick Maloney was going home with the vegetables on Thursday evening to cook supper for her husband. That's the way she told herself. Do everything right and natural. Keep things absolutely natural, and there'll be no need for any acting at all. Therefore, when she entered the kitchen by the back door, she was humming a little tune to herself and smiling. "Patrick," she called, "how are you, darling?" She put the parcel down on the table and went through the living room. When she saw him lying there on the floor with his legs doubled up and one arm twisted back beneath his body, it really was rather a shock. All the old love and longing for him welled up inside her. She ran over to him, knelt down beside him, and began to cry her heart out. It was easy. No acting was necessary. A few minutes later, she got up and went to the phone. She knew the number of the police station, and when the man at the other end answered, she cried to him, "Quick! Come quick! Patrick's dead!" "Who's speaking?" "Mrs. Maloney! Mrs. Patrick Maloney!" "You mean Patrick Maloney's dead?" "I think so," she sobbed. He's lying on the floor, and I think he's dead." "Be right over," the man said. The car came very quickly, and when she opened the front door, two policemen walked in. She knew them both. She knew nearly all the men at the precinct. She fell right into a chair, then went over to join the other one, who was called O'Malley, kneeling by the body. "Is he dead?" she cried. "I'm afraid he is." "What happened?" Briefly, she told her story about going out to the grocer and coming back to find him on the floor. While she was talking, crying and talking, Noonan discovered a small patch of congealed blood on the dead man's head. He showed it to O'Malley, who got up at once and hurried to the phone. Soon, other men began to come to the house. First a doctor, then two detectives, one of whom she knew by name. Later, a police photographer arrived and took pictures, and a man who knew about fingerprints. There was a great deal of whispering and muttering beside the corpse, and the detectives kept asking her a lot of questions, but they always treated her kindly. She told her story again, this time right from the beginning, when Patrick had come in and she was sewing and he was tired, so tired he hadn't wanted to go out for supper. She told how she'd put the meat in the oven. "It's there now, cooking," and how she'd slipped out to the grocer for vegetables and come back to find him lying on the floor. "Which grocer?" one of the detectives asked. She told him, and he turned and whispered something to the other detective, who immediately went outside into the street. In 15 minutes he was back with a page of notes, and there was more whispering, and through her sobbing she heard a few of the whispered phrases. "Acted quite normal, very cheerful, wanted to give him a good supper, peas, cheesecake. Impossible that she..." After a while, the photographer and the doctor departed, and two other men came in and took the corpse away on a stretcher. Then the fingerprint man went away. The two detectives remained, and so did the two policemen. They were exceptionally nice to her, and Jack Noonan asked if she wouldn't rather go somewhere else, to her sister's house, perhaps, or even to his own wife, who would take care of her and put her up for the night. "No," she said. "She didn't feel she could move even a yard at the moment. Would they mind awfully if she stayed just where she was until she felt better? She didn't feel too good at the moment. She really didn't." "Then hadn't she better lie down on the bed?" Jack Noonan asked. "No," she said. "She'd like to stay right where she was, in this chair. A little later, perhaps, when she felt better, she would move." So they left her there while they went about their business searching the house. Occasionally, one of the detectives asked her another question. Sometimes Jack Noonan spoke to her pleasantly as he passed. Her husband, he told her, had been killed by a blow on the back of the head, administered with a heavy, blunt instrument, almost certainly a large piece of metal. They were looking for the weapon. The murderer may have taken it with him, but on the other hand, he may have thrown it away or hidden it somewhere on the premises. "It's the old story," he said. "Get the weapon and you've got the man." Later, one of the detectives came up and sat beside her. "Did she know," he asked, "of anything in the house that could have been used as a weapon? Would she mind having a look around to see if anything was missing? A very big spanner, for example, or a heavy metal vase?" "They didn't have any heavy metal vases," she said. "Or a big spanner?" She didn't think they had a big spanner, but there might be some things like that in the garage. The search went on. She knew that there were other policemen in the garden all around the house. She could hear their footsteps on the gravel outside, and sometimes she saw a flash of a torch through the chink in the curtains. It began to get late, nearly 9, when she noticed by the clock on the mantel. The 4 men searching the room seemed to be growing weary, a trifle exasperated. "Jack," she said the next time Sergeant Noonan went by, "would you mind giving me a drink?" "Sure, I'll give you a drink. You mean this whiskey?" "Yes, please. Just a small one. It might make me feel better." He handed her the glass. "Why don't you have one yourself?" she said. "You must be awfully tired." "Please do. You've been very good to me." "Well," he answered, "it's not strictly allowed, but I might take just a drop to keep me going." One by one, the others came in and were persuaded to take a little nip of whiskey. They stood around rather awkwardly with the drinks in their hands, uncomfortable in her presence, trying to say consoling things to her. Sergeant Noonan wandered into the kitchen, came out quickly, and said, "Look, Mrs. Maloney, you know that oven of yours is still on, and the meat's still inside." "Oh, dear me," she cried, "so it is. I'd better turn it off for you, hadn't I?" "Oh, will you do that, Jack? Thank you so much." When the sergeant returned the second time, she looked at him with her large, dark, tearful eyes. "Jack Noonan," she said. "Yes." "Would you do me a small favor, you and these others?"
"We can try, Mrs. Maloney."
"Well," she said, "here you all are, and good friends of dear Patrick's, too, and helping to catch the man who killed him. You must be terribly hungry by now, because it's long past your supper time. And I know Patrick would never forgive me, God bless his soul, if I allowed you to remain in this house without offering you decent hospitality. Why don't you eat up that lamb that's in the oven? It'll be cooked just right by now."
"Wouldn't dream of it," Sergeant Newton said.
"Oh, please," she begged, "please eat it. Personally, I couldn't touch a thing. Certainly not what's been in the house while he was here. But it's all right for you. It'd be a favor to me if you'd eat it up. Then you can go on with your work again afterwards." There was a good deal of hesitating among the 4 policemen, but they were clearly hungry, and in the end they were persuaded to go into the kitchen and help themselves. The woman stayed where she was, listening to them speaking among themselves, their voices thick and sloppy because their mouths were full of meat.
"Have some more, Charlie?" "Nah, better not finish it. She wants us to finish it. She said so. Be doing her a favor." "Okay, then. Give me some more."
"A hell of a big club the guy must have used to hit poor Patrick," one of them was saying. "Doc says his skull was smashed all to pieces, just like from a sledgehammer." "That's why it ought to be easy to find. Exactly what I say. Whoever done it, they're not going to be carrying around a thing like that with them longer than they need to." One of them belched. "Personally, I think it's right here on the premises. Probably right under our very noses. What do you think, Jack?" And in the other room, Mary Maloney began to giggle.
Judy and Mike, thank you for 2 excellent presentations. They're just wonderful. Let me add that both Judy and Mike, in addition to being members of the Community Players of Salisbury, are also part of the repertory group that we use here at the radio station when we put together our Delmarva Radio Theater productions. And I thank you for that as well. Judy and Mike, what are the production plans of the Community Players of Salisbury this winter?
Well, our next production is going to be One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Mike will be playing a wonderful role in that, Dale Harding. I will not be in this one, might be advising on set, but Mike is going to be a superstar, as always.
Mike?
Yeah, the show looks great. It is based on the novel by Ken Kesey. It was a Broadway show in the 60s. Yeah, Kirk Douglas originally. And then there was a revival a few years ago with Gary Sinise. I think it's a little different than what we've done in the past. Mostly male cast with some very adult themes, I guess. So a little different than most. I think we're striking out a little bit as a community theater group.
Mike, give us a little bit of the story for those who are not as old as I am and didn't read Cuckoo's Nest or see the film. What's this about? What's going on here?
So the main story is about a character named Randall P. McMurphy. He is a ruffian, I guess, a guy who ends up in jail quite frequently, and in one of his jail stops, convinces a psychiatrist that he might be a psychopath. And so they send him to a state mental hospital. And he thinks it's going to be a vacation, and it really ends up not being a vacation for him. And it's sort of his interaction with not just the characters, the other men that are in the state hospital who are all long-term residents. This is set in the 60s, so back when people would spend years and years in mental hospitals. So it's about his interactions with them, but also his interactions with the administrators of the hospital, mainly Nurse Ratched.
Well, say something about Nurse Ratched.
Well, she is, by all appearances, a sickeningly sweet and loving character on the outside, but really, yeah, evil, sticks it to him. It's somebody who is manipulative and just terrible. I mean, but like you said, a very iconic character in literature. I mean, I think the term ratchet has been used in modern,
whether intentionally or not.
Right, modern language. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've heard it, Don. You know, she's a regular Nurse Ratched.
Yeah. And the thing about the play, the play follows the novel much more closely than the film did. The bus scene and the fishing scene weren't in the original novel. The novel, if you remember, was written from the perspective of the Native American character, Chief Bromden, and who's a schizophrenic. And the scenes within his head were written by Ken Kesey. Ken Kesey, if you don't remember, was a orderly at the Oregon State Mental Hospital and would go to work after taking LSD. And so he would write these scenes under the influence of a psychogenic and came up with this Chief Bromden scenes while he was on LSD. And so if you remember, those scenes were very out there. And they are translated well in the play. There are scenes where Chief Bromden has monologues and spotlights and speaks to his father and to other characters from the Native American community, and tries to explain what's been going on in his world, a world where he feels like he's just a piece of machinery and the hospital has been manipulating him with wires and devices and he's schizophrenic. And that part is very key to the play and follows the novel much more closely than the movie did. The movie was more about the Randall P. McMurphy character. The play is very much about the Native American Chief Bromden and McMurphy.
And you're doing scenery, Judy. Now, tell me why you're not Nurse Ratched in this in this play.
Let's not get into that. I would love to have been Nurse Ratched, but didn't work out that way. What I do with the community players, if it is a musical, since I do not sing at all, I will do the set work. And so, for instance, in our last show, Matilda, I had done all of the set work for that. Well, not the building, but the painting of it. So with many of the shows, I will either be doing the set or I will be in the show or sometimes both. And in this case, I'll be more in an advisory capacity, just kind of advising on colors because there's not too much in the way of being super uber creative with it, where Matilda had to be a very creative piece. Some of the others we've done in the past, like Les Miserables or Into the Woods, there's some that have been very, very involved but this one should be a much simpler deal.
When is it going to be presented to the public?
It opens January 31st and plays that weekend of the 31st and then the following weekend, 7th, 8th, and 9th. It's at Warwick. So the first weekend, it's on Friday night, Saturday during the day, and evening, and then the next weekend it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Thank you again, Mike and Judy. We began our broadcast with the Frenchman and the Frog story. That is an old joke, as you know. And then Mike and Judy beautifully read two stories that we confessed are not particularly seasonal. So in the spirit of the holiday season, let me end our program with A Visit from St. Nicholas in the Ernest Hemingway manner, written by James Thurber for The New Yorker and published in 1927. The new style Hemingway was developing, hard-boiled, short sentences, direct, understated, and exhibiting no sentimentality, was the talk of the literary world in 1927. A Visit from St. Nicholas in the Hemingway manner was written by Thurber as a satire on this popular and much discussed style of Hemingway. And now, here is James Thurber's satirical version of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, as Ernest Hemingway would have written it. It was the night before Christmas. The house was very quiet. No creatures were stirring in the house. There weren't even any mice stirring. The stockings had been hung carefully by the chimney. The children hoped that St. Nicholas would come and fill them. The children were in their beds. Their beds were in the room next to ours. Mama and I were in our beds. Mama wore a kerchief. I had my hat on. I could hear the children moving. We didn't move. We wanted the children to think we were asleep. Father, the children said. There was no answer. He's there all right, they thought. Father, they said, and banged on their beds. What do you want? I asked. We have some visions of sugar plums, the children said. Go to sleep, Mama said. We can't sleep, said the children. They stopped talking, but I could hear them moving. They made sounds. Can you sleep? Asked the children. No, I said. You ought to sleep. I know I ought to sleep. Can we have some sugar plums? You can't have any sugar plums, said Mama. We just asked you. There was a long silence. I could hear the children moving again. Is St. Nicholas asleep? Asked the children. No, Mama said. Be quiet. What the hell would he be asleep tonight for? I asked. He might be, the children said. He isn't, I said. Let's try to sleep, Mama said. The house became quiet once more. I could hear the rustling noises the children made when they moved in their beds. Out on the lawn, a clatter arose. I got out of bed and went to the window. I opened the shutters. Then I threw up the sash. The moon shone on the snow. The moon gave the luster of midday to objects in the snow. There was a miniature sleigh in the snow and 8 tiny reindeer. A little man was driving them. He was lively and quick. He whistled and shouted at the reindeer and called them by their names. Their names were Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donder, and Blitzen. He told them to dash away to the top of the porch, and then he told them to dash away to the top of the wall. They did. The sleigh was full of toys. "Who is it?" Mama asked. "Some guy," I said, "a little guy." I pulled my head in out of the window and listened. I heard the reindeer on the roof. I could hear their hooves pawing and prancing on the roof. "Shut the window," said Mama. I stood still and listened. "What do you hear?" "Reindeer," I said. I shut the window and walked about. It was cold. Mama sat up in the bed and looked at me. "How would they get on the roof?" Mama asked. "They fly." "Get into bed. You'll catch cold." Mama lay down in bed. I didn't get into bed. I kept walking around. "What do you mean they fly?" asked Mama. "Just fly is all." Mama turned toward the wall. She didn't say anything. I went out into the room where the chimney was. The little man came down the chimney and stepped into the room. He was dressed all in fur. His clothes were covered with ashes and soot from the chimney. On his back was a pack, like a peddler's pack. There were toys in it. His cheeks and nose were red, and he had dimples. His eyes twinkled. His mouth was little like a bow, and his beard was very white. Between his teeth was a stumpy pipe. The smoke from the pipe encircled his head in a wreath. He laughed, and his belly shook. It shook like a bowl of red jelly. I laughed. He winked his eye, then he gave a twist to his head. He didn't say anything. He turned to the chimney and filled the stockings and turned away from the chimney. Laying his finger aside his nose, he gave a nod. Then he went up the chimney. I went to the chimney and looked up. I saw him get into his sleigh. He whistled at his team, and the team flew away. The team flew as lightly as thistledown. The driver called out, "Merry Christmas and good night." I went back to bed. "What was it?" asked Mama. "St. Nicholas." She smiled. "Yeah," I said. She sighed and turned in the bed. "I saw him," I said. "Sure." "I did see him." "Sure, you saw him." She turned further toward the wall. "Father," said the children. "There you go," Mama said, "you and your flying reindeer." "Go to sleep," I said. "Can we see St. Nicholas when he comes?" the children asked. "You got to be asleep," I said. "You got to be asleep when he comes. You can't see him unless you're unconscious." "Father knows," Mama said. I pulled the covers over my mouth. It was warm under the covers. As I went to sleep, I wondered if Mama was right. James Thurber, channeling Hemingway. I hope you've enjoyed our stories. Now a great thanks again to my guests, Judy Hearn and Mike Murphy. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Happy holidays to all of you.